Welcome to the Monday Minute of the Hunt Backcountry Podcast. These are shorter and more informal episodes where we answer listener questions. Joined as usual by Steve. How are you, man?
Good, real good. Woke up to surprise like 3, 4 inches of snow. We've been incredibly warm February, but looks like winter's trying to hang on a little bit, which I don't mind at all. Yeah, ready to tackle the week.
Yeah, it is it's gonna be a week for sure. There's a lot going on, and we were just chatting before we hit record on death hike and training, and that is essentially exactly about a month out. So goodness, that's coming fast.
Yeah, man. Yeah, training's going good. Oh, my left knee was a little twingy. I went out yesterday morning, just did a quick 4 miles. But yeah, overall, feeling good, feeling ready. Just keep at it. Kind of ramp up for 2-ish, 2.5 weeks probably, and then buy the taper.
That transitions into a question that I want to dive into. This guy wrote in and said, I'm planning on heading out for my first real expedition sheep hunt in Alaska this fall. My brother and I are planning on going out for 7 to 10 days. I know that you, Mark, and Steve have been in my position at one point, and I'm wondering where to find information such as training, gear, planning, logistics, etc. He said, I try and make it out for a few backpack hunts each fall, so I'm familiar with that aspect. I've just never hunted sheep before, so I'm looking for any information I can find to increase my chances of success. So there's a lot in there, and we'll talk actually more about gear and things in a second. But he also, in this email, wrapped up by saying, realistically, how much should I train and what should my training consist of? This guy's writing in a sheep hunting context, but I think we can broaden that out maybe for other listeners and say, you're just kind of taking a hunt to the next level. Like maybe you're going on a backpack hunt for the first time or whatever. We talk about training. It's a hot topic. There's plenty of programs and all kinds of stuff out there. But this whole idea of realistically, how much should I train? For him specifically, Steve, what comes to mind?
You could not, I mean, this applies to everything, right? But you could not possibly be in too good of shape, right? So, as a general rule, start training now and train as much as you possibly can until season comes. If you gotta, I think every single person's guilty of saying, oh, I don't have time. I don't have an hour a day. I don't have this. I don't have that. You have to take a good, honest look at your life and say, is that true statement or not? Can you get up an hour earlier? Can you train after you put the kids to bed? Can you squeeze in an hour in the middle of the day, like not take a lunch? That's generally my like year-round type deal. I don't take lunches. I just grab a sandwich, eat at my desk, and then use lunchtime to go for a hike or something. So you cannot overtrain. If truly time is, going to be a limiting factor, then yeah, then you got to start getting specific. And, I'm not going to say that we're experts in that regard. There's plenty of good resources out there right now. But I would just say, I guess through my own experience and through talking with a lot of people, number one, get a pack on your back, start hiking. Number two, mix it up as well. So say if you had let's just say you can only find 4 hours during the entire week. So I'd spend 2 hours a week hiking with a loaded pack and the other 2 hours doing, either I'd go trail running one day, I'd lift the other day. You probably need to lift more than one day a week. But I guess the point there would be like get some, variety in what you're doing. And then I think where I've made mistakes in the past is probably I hike too much and then don't do like where you're gonna get sore would be kind of the more I guess where when it happens to me it's the more extreme not extreme movements but the more exaggerated movements of like a lunging like just basically doing lunges things like that that are really like exaggerated of what your normal walking step would look like. Man, I can just you start rambling on and on and on about this. You got to get weighted heavy packs going. Obviously, like I've talked plenty in the past about my mountain biking experience and how much that helps build like a baseline of endurance level and also cardio fitness level where you just recover quickly. So this guy can go, you can go down the wormhole, man, as much as you want. Or, I think the I've been on two sheep hunts in Alaska. There are quote unquote easy sheep hunts, and there's absolutely brutal ones. So you would need to talk to your guide, outfitter, and get a general idea of where you're going, the mountains that you're hunting. What, I think they're hard is always a we've perspective, right? And so he might be, oh, it's absolutely terrible, but the guy could be like 60 years old and not in great shape, and maybe it's not that bad. But I would get like a general, like, okay, you should expect to be hiking this miles and this many feet of elevation every single day. But there's sheep hunts that you literally they get you in there. They've already like somehow got four wheelers and stuff like that, and you can ride up these river bottoms and park, and then oh, there's the sheep, 2,000 feet above you, and climb up and shoot one. Like it can be that easy, or go back to listen to your sheep story from last year, right? Like that one's an impressive physical feat. All this, yeah, all doing all this rambling, like this guy's a, I guess from my perspective, it's going to be a lot of stuff we cover in the content project this year, getting training and getting ready for these types of hunts and what to do and not do, but. You could just, yeah, I don't think you can do too much. You disagree?
Yeah, I mean, that's what stood out to me in his question is like when he says, realistically, how much should I train? And of course, we don't know where he's coming from, what his
Right.
normal activity level is, what his fitness is, etc. But as you said, you can't be in too good of shape. You can overtrain to the extent of like creating injuries and etc. So I think it's a great time to be asking this question because we have a bunch of months to work with between now and sheep season, which is going to come fast, but it's not like he's trying to ramp up in 4 weeks or something. So when it comes to saying realistically, how much should I train? That's what stood out to me. And I don't know if it's just the mindset that I'm in right now with training for the death hike. And I know you're in the same boat, Steve, but it does take a lot of intentionality and sacrifice to be able to train enough, meaning you are going to have to like get really purposeful with how you're using your time, finding windows of time and making windows of time to get good training in. And so if I were this guy, especially between now and August 1, right? I would get as literal as not just thinking through, oh, I'm going to follow this training plan or sign up for whatever, Mountain Tough or Atomic Athlete or any of the things that we've talked about before, which are all great things. But I'd be more focused on day to day, week to week. How can I set up my schedule for success? So maybe that's like you said, Steve, in the micro, like start skipping lunch breaks and using that time otherwise, but also macro of saying, I have these months between now and August and putting it on the calendar and finding windows of time for longer training slash testing mini events, essentially, right? How can you not just go do a workout, but how can you find 4, 6, 8 hours to go do some sort of hike, some sort of challenge, whatever? And, a lot of times that's gonna involve you giving up some things or doing it at weird times or even losing some sleep, which of course isn't sustainable day after day after day, but it totally is a great thing to do from a training perspective. Because in all reality, that's what things are like on a hunt. You're going to be tired. You're going to be uncomfortable. The weather's going to be unpredictable. And so I can't tell you how many times I've done this where it's like I have to look ahead and go, okay, I'm going to get up at literally 2 or 3 a.m. to be able to get in a long training day and maybe still get home and see my family on a Saturday. And that sucks, but it's also great training. And there's been times where I've done that and put on the calendar ahead of time, and then the weather's terrible. And it's like, well, this is the time I got. This is when we're going, which is again the same way of hunting. So we could get into the nitty-gritty, and we've obviously done a lot of training podcasts on specific things you should do, like weighted hiking and lunges and all that stuff. But I just wanted for this guy to call out, you can't train too much and basically think yes about working out and consistency in training, but also like working in these mini events, finding longer chunks of time to get out and really test yourself, your mindset, and even sometimes that means gear and nutrition, for example, as well. I mean, that's something with like again training for death hikes is not only is, you know, a 4 or 6 hour training event great training, but it's an opportunity to really put some time in to footwear and to really test nutrition and things like that. And I would take the same approach for something like this guy's sheep hunt.
Specific to this guy, because it sounds, they said, yeah, has the words he used there sound like he wanted to do the minimum to get by. Realistically, how much do I need to do? And obviously, I have no idea, is he already in very good shape or does he have 50 pounds of this? You have no idea. But if nothing else, like the motivation of he's spending. And I guess it could be going to the brother-in-law, right, or something, or a brother
Yeah,
that
he
lives
did
up
say
there
my
and doing this for
brother and
cheap.
I, so they could be going DIY for sure. But either way, it's going to take cost and time.
And what I was, yeah, my head was like, you're spending, sheep hunts are 25, 30 grand now, more. You're spending a lot of money, and I can almost guarantee if we interviewed 1,000 guides, like, what's the one thing that shuts down a hunt, and it's going to be the hunter's fitness level and getting sore and needing to take days off, right? Mental toughness always also obviously plays a giant role in that. But hunters show up, they're not prepared, they get sore, they call it quits. Like, if you want to be successful, I think the number one thing you can do is be physically and mentally prepared for the hunt.
Well, speaking of sheep hunt, I last week recorded a video going through everything that was in my pack for my sheep hunt from last fall, which is something I've been wanting to do since last fall, but things have just been so busy, between hunting season finishing up, rolling into holidays, rolling into show season, etc. So, we're basically 6 months out from my sheep hunt, and I'm just now putting out that video. I did want to do it after the hunt on purpose versus like a before the hunt, what's in my pack, because I wanted to be able to talk about how things performed. And then it's also not short. Like I went through everything and I've gotten a lot of questions, whether it's through the podcast or directly since the sheep hunt, about certain things I used or what I liked or didn't like, and some very specific questions. So I took the time to work all that in. So all that said to say, to you guys listening to the podcast, this isn't out yet, meaning is this Monday? Man, it's going to come out, but it's going to come out on Wednesday. So, two things you can do to catch it is one, you could subscribe to our YouTube channel, or two, make sure you're subscribed to our emails. Better yet, do both. But that's coming out Wednesday, and I go through everything I took on my sheep hunt. And I'll also have not just the video, but the spreadsheet, the same format that we've shared in the past, like the gear list spreadsheet, the very specific one for my sheep hunt with all the links to all the things. So, speaking of sheep, that is coming this week as well. I didn't tell you I was doing that, Steve. So, surprise. And then another surprise for you, Steve. There's a contact we had through Maven. And I guess the backstory there is a podcast listener who reached out about something else years ago, now works for Maven. He didn't at the time. So I've actually exchanged emails with this guy, and he happens to work for Maven now. He reached out when he heard us talking, Steve, about scopes and the content project and et cetera, and just wanted to get our take on their RS1, or should I say RS1.2, which is an updated version of one of their rifle scopes. So he sent that to me. I'm going to do some testing. I'm going to hand it off to you, Steve. But just wanted to say it's checking a lot of boxes. It's looking to be a very good scope, and it's also one of the scopes that's been tested on Rockslide. So if you guys are unfamiliar with that, they've been doing a lot of drop testing and reliability testing on Rockslide, and it's performed very well there. But having now got my hands on it, it's a killer scope, a little bit heavier than what I try to stick to, and I know what you try to stick to, Steve. It's at 26 ounces, but it's a 2.5 to 15. It's got a lot going for it. It's a first focal plane with, I've always struggled with first focal plane scopes, for a purely hunting scope because of at low magnification, most of those reticles are very, very difficult to use. But this is a great reticle design, which is to me one of the biggest benefits it brings. Like, yes, it has clear glass, and yes, it has good adjustments. The turrets feel fantastic. It's a toolless adjustment system. There's a lot of things I like to it, but what intrigued me as well was just this reticle design that they're using. And it makes it pretty appealing for a first focal plane scope if, as a hunter, you've struggled in the past with using those at low magnification. So more to come on that. Do some testing, beat it up, hand it to you, Steve, to do some testing and beat it up. But it's looking good so far.
Cool.
We had a question come in, kind of a follow-up. This guy wrote in and said, on a recent Monday Minute, you addressed a question regarding drying clothes in a down sleeping bag. He said, I'd like to follow up on that. I was recently in Southeast Alaska on a goat hunt, and it was extremely wet. On the hike up into the mountains, we got soaked to the bone. My guide had a down sleeping bag with treated down, and he was able to sleep in his wet clothes and dry them out. I have a Western mountaineering down bag with a Gore-Tex outer shell. The combination worked well, and the down stayed lofted throughout the hunt. However, with the untreated down and the less breathable shell, I was scared to try and dry my clothes using that method in the sleeping bag. I had brought a complete set of extra clothes, and I was very careful to ensure they stayed dry. We were in the mountains for 5 days, and there was only a couple of hours over that time when it wasn't raining. My wet clothes never dried out, and babying my remaining clothes impacted my hunt. Do you know if I could have dried out my clothes inside my bag, or would I have soaked my down? So again, he's following up on a conversation and mentions we've made, Steve, about drying yourself out in a sleeping bag, including with down. But one thing that's unique, and this, I really wanted to address this question because we've said so many times the details matter, the devil's in the details. So in his particular situation, he was using a sleeping bag with natural down that was untreated. So, no hydrophobic, hydrophilic, whatever you want to call it, coating on the down itself. It's not water resistant down. And I think this is even more important to think through, his sleeping bag had a Gore-Tex shell. So, instead of it being your traditional base fabric, it's actually Gore-Tex. Which sounds like a great idea in theory for a wet environment, but I think it creates a massive problem for his scenario. And he concluded by saying, do you know if I could have dried out my down clothes inside my bag, or would I have soaked my down? I would say that it was a good move. He did not try to sleep himself dry in this specific situation of having untreated down, but even I think more importantly, or just as important, this Gore-Tex shell, because that shell is not going to allow the moisture to pass through the down and truly escape the sleep system. So I think not only one, would he have not dried himself effectively, but two, he would have introduced moisture into his down sleeping system that would not have escaped because of this Gore-Tex shell. And this question came through this week, and also this week there was an updated video from John Barklum having a, I'm spacing on the name of the little project he does outside of Sitka with education, Knowledge from Storms, I think. But he had a video, and there's been videos like this about the rewarming drill where you purposely get wet in your clothing and then how to handle that in a cold environment. And they were going through it. And there's a moment in this video that relates directly to this guy's question, although the scenario is slightly different. And in this video, John Barklow was with this other guy who went head to toe in the river, and now they're in this very cold environment. And they immediately put on the puffy gear. They immediately set up a shelter. They're inside the shelter. They're starting to dry out, et cetera. They took the first steps to prevent hypothermia and maintain function. And then how can we continue from here and dry out our system? And one of the things that John said to this guy that he was with was, "Hey, do you have a shell on, like in your clothing system? Do you still have your shell on?" And this is the same thing as this guy's sleeping bag scenario. And John highlighted the fact any laminate will slow down the drying process. And so that's just important to think through. There's a lot of talk about waterproof and breathable, but they're usually somewhat mutually exclusive from a true function standpoint. And so if you're just thinking through how am I going to dry myself out, maybe a similar situation would be trying to sleep yourself dry and it's a standard sleeping bag, maybe without a Gore-Tex shell, but don't have your rain gear on. I know that seems basic when you think about it, but I've seen people talk about it and people do it. And in this guy's scenario, just making sure you don't have any sort of windproof, waterproof, et cetera, laminate in any portion of the system where you're trying to dry yourself out. So I'll leave a link to that video in the show description, but also just wanted to answer this guy's question. And it made me think even further, Steve, about the benefit of any sleeping bag with a Gore-Tex shell. I don't know that there's a situation where that would be my first choice because you could always add protection with like a bivy versus truly having Gore-Tex built into your sleep system. I think it's just going to be very limiting.
Yeah, I don't even know if I've seen one before. Have
Yeah, I
you
mean, they
seen a
make them.
Gore-Tex sleeping bag? Huh.
Yeah, they certainly make them. But yeah, an interesting one to think through because, again, the devil's in the details. It's not just this broad, like, hey, can you dry yourself out in a down sleeping bag if you're wet? Potentially. This guy said his guide did it. But again, this guide was using a different sleeping bag with a breathable shell and a water resistant down versus this guy, the hunter who wrote the question in, totally different scenario. So, on topic of sleep systems, I'm trying to group stuff together here because we have a lot of listener questions. But Dennis had wrote in and said, I attended the Western Hunting Expo for the first time this year and was quite impressed with all the exhibits. I arrived Thursday and left Saturday morning, and I regret not staying another night to visit with vendor exhibits all day Saturday. There were so many things that I could have done with another day. So that's cool to hear just because Steve, you and I have said what a cool show it is. It was nice to hear Dennis say it was his first time and worth the trip, and he essentially wishes he would have stayed longer. But then he went on to say, while I was there, I noticed several sleeping bags with a top center zipper, and later learned from a video promotion that the center zip design on the new Peaks Soleless 15 sleeping bag allows you to use that sleeping bag as a quilt. Have you considered this idea, and do you have any thoughts about the merits of this concept? And then he said, thank you very much for your non-sponsored perspective on the gear we use in the backcountry. So again, I'm trying to group questions on sleep systems today. I haven't used this bag. I saw the announcement of it. I have not put my hands on it, so all kinds of caveats. I have zero personal experience, and I think the best thing we could do to weigh in on this is think out loud. And I think that's beneficial not because of you or I, Steve, offering thoughts on a product we haven't used, but like thinking out loud in the sense of like, how do we assess things a little bit? Or like, what are some of the questions we would have as we evaluate new gear in general? The first thing I noticed is that the price on this thing is crazy high, in my opinion. The tall version, which is just what I would buy, is $695. $700. The standard version wasn't that much cheaper. And that's a lot for a sleeping bag. I mean, I feel like the katabatic I've used and talk about so much is far from like the cheapest quilt, and it's $400. So I mean, it's darn near half the price. $400 versus $700 essentially. And again, I don't think the katabatic is by any means cheap, because there's a lot more affordable options out there. And I would just say, if I personally was shopping for something and considering spending $700, there's a lot of other options, including a lot of stuff made in the USA where you could go full custom for that type of price point. So that's one thing that stands out to me, is there's pricing. And then, in looking at sleep systems in general, and we've said this about even down clothing, it's important to just try and compare specs as much as possible. And one of those is, anytime you're looking at any sleep system or down clothing, like trying to figure out not only what type of down fill is it. So is it like an 850 goose down or duck down, or 900 fill power, 750 fill power, et cetera. So there's the fill type and fill power, but also how much of that fill is actually in there. So how many ounces of fill are in this item? I couldn't find that on the Peaks. I didn't see it listed on the product page. Maybe it's somewhere else, but that's something, that is just helpful to look at with any sleep system or any garment. And then, yeah, this idea of the design and the center zip, I've certainly seen it done before. Sitka has one. They've had one for years with like a center zip. And then the other unique thing on this Peaks one is it has these armholes. So essentially, they're this concept where you can like wear the sleeping bag, right? Like if you're out glassing, you can put your arms out and you can sit and be cozy in the sleeping bag and glass. Again, I have actually used that Sitka one as well. It does the same thing. To me, it's one of the features that sounds cool in theory, but just isn't practical. Like, I'm just not actually really going to use it. I could see how it'd be handy, even in the tent, if you wanted to be like in your sleeping bag, but have your arms out to cook or something, I guess. But I've just never found that to be a real, real big benefit. And then this idea of taking a center zip sleeping bag, and in this case, essentially flipping it upside down so that the center zip opening is below you. And then now it's a quilt. Again, I think it provides some theoretical versatility there. But to me, it's like, I would just think through, do you really want a quilt or do you want a sleeping bag? Because, and we've said this so much about a lot of gear, if you try and have one thing that does everything, a lot of times you're making compromises. Worry if you had something a little bit more intentionally designed to do one thing and do it incredibly effectively well, you're generally a bit better off. So one thing, like, question I would have on, again, this isn't just the Peaks, but any of these center zip sleeping bags that flip and turn into a quilt, is really looking at the attachment system. Because to me, that's one thing that the effectiveness of a quilt is heavily dependent upon the attachment system, the attachment method, and how that works with you and your pad. And I didn't see any sort of attachment system on this. So that would be one thing I would look at as well. So I don't know. Have you seen not just this Peak, Steve, but any of these ideas or hybrid sleeping bags or any of this stuff?
Yeah, I hate talking about something I saw online, but I've never seen in person, never used, right? Like, I mean, there may be some really cool features about this that we don't know. But in general, like, the first thing I'm gonna do is like, okay, what's that looks cool? What does it weigh? All right, it's going in my backpack, so weight is the probably, not number one concern, but top two generally, just depending on what that item is. And then in regards, specifically to something sleeping bag, like you said, I'm going to go look at the down fill weight. All right, it's 22 ounces with 14 ounces of 900 fill. Through experience, I know that that's probably going to be a pretty good combination. And then if it looks good, it's like, oh, all right, that's worth trying out. I can't wrap my head around why everybody doesn't just use a quilt. I just don't get it, frankly. They're they just outperform sleeping bags in every single regard from my own experience. So when I see something new pop up that's not a quilt, I don't understand it. But yeah, I guess there's a few, if you're just tossing and turning all night in your sleep, yeah, you may, depending on the pad attachment system, you may get a few drafts from a quilt. But like sleeping bags, mummy bags are generally always not very comfortable either. You're kind of, if you're tossing and turning, it's twisting around your body. I think I did see on this Peaks one, I watched the video on it when it first came out, where they've got some stretch panels inside, try to alleviate some of that. But anyways, yeah, I just try a quilt first. If it just makes so much more sense, in my mind. But maybe it's awesome. I don't know.
Yeah, again, I'm not trying to make this about this Peaks bag. I'm using this as a context of like weighing through new gear and concepts and like just making decisions, right? So, is the, 'cause there's honestly so many questions we get on gear, and especially new gear that gets announced, that we just ignore a lot of them 'cause we don't speak to it. And there's a lot of things that we just flat out won't try because we already have something that works, or this new product meets our needs, et cetera. So again, this is just one example of, I could give you dozens of things we get questions about. And it's like, here's just how we begin to ask questions and look at things. So maybe that's helpful. 'Cause there's just a lot to it.
Yeah, I think so much of that just comes from experience and thinking technically about gear for a lot of years, that you can now, in general, look at something and go, I like that. I don't like this. Oh, that looks interesting. I'm going to give that a shot. But I don't know how you shortcut that other than just trying out a bunch of stuff, which, you and I don't live in the real world like we are exposed to and get to test lots and lots and lots of gear that the average guy doesn't.
More and more, when I think about it, there's so much out there, Steve, where people would just be very well, I think, well served by buying used gear and just trying it. Like, a quilt, again, like maybe people hear you and what you just said, or have heard us in the past talk about trying a quilt. And it's like, I would say, yeah, maybe don't go buy a $400 one off the bat. Like we've talked before about hammock gear, and they make good budget quilts. But even more so, if you can go buy a used one, I'm not saying this just about quilts, this could apply to so many things, and you find something at a decent price that you're willing to try, go try it, because you bought it used and didn't pay retail. And whatever you bought it for, if you don't destroy it or make it worse, you're probably just being able to turn around and sell it for what you just bought it for, right? Because it's already been marked down. You've already paid, that used price. So take quilts as just one of many examples. If you go buy one like right now in the off season and you try it, you do a backpacking trip, shoot, try it in your yard for a couple nights, or just even get your hands on one for the first time, you can decide if it does or doesn't work for you. And if it doesn't work for you, you can probably turn around and literally sell what you just bought it for. Because again, you already bought it cheaper because it was used. And I would just say extrapolate that out into quite a few things. Because as you said, Steve, you and I get to try a lot. Plus, we have, just past years of experience of trying things. And for a lot of guys who don't have that and then can't put their hands on as much gear, I just think buying used and not being afraid to like buy and sell a little bit, it's such a great opportunity to truly try stuff out. So,
Yeah, or take advantage of, a lot of companies have a pretty generous 30-day return policy. Like you could probably buy a quilt, go sleep in your backyard for a night where it's a nice clean environment and decide you like it or don't like it. And if you don't, send it back and you're out $15 in shipping or something.
cool, guys. Well, we have a bunch more questions we'll get to on future episodes, and are always open to hearing even more questions. So if you have something for us, just send an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Once again, the resources we mentioned today, that video I mentioned about rewarming, and that tech tip from John Barklow, I'll leave a link to our YouTube channel. I have that sheep gear video coming out this week, So just be sure to always check the show notes for any resources. I'll leave a link to that Maven Scope as well. If you guys haven't heard of that and want to go check it out. So as always, you can find all that and you can find us at exomountgear.com/podcast. And there's also links to all previous episodes, as well as the ability to search by keyword and filter by topic and a whole bunch of stuff. So check that out if you haven't already. And thanks as always for tuning in.